Welcome to the Lift Every Voice podcast, where we explore books by contemplative writers of color. I'm Christine Walters Paintner.
And I'm Claudia Love Meyer. We are joined each month by the author of our book club selection. Together, we explore how increasing our diversity of perspectives on contemplative practice can enrich our experience of the Christian mystical tradition.
We encourage you to join us by reading the book, listening to the conversations, and engaging with the reflection questions on our website at abbeyofthearts.com. Welcome, everybody, to the Lift Every Voice Book Club. I am Christine Walters Paintner, and I'm delighted, as always, to be joined by Claudia Love Meyer, who's my ongoing partner in conversation. And today we are delighted to be welcoming Dr. Patrick Reyes, who's the best-selling author of the award-winning books, The Purpose Gap, which is the book we'll be discussing today, Empowering Communities of Color to Find Meaning and Thrive, and Nobody Cries When We Die. He's also completing his third book, Pedagogy of the Ancestors, which I'm especially excited to read. He's the host of The Sound of the Genuine podcast, a Chicano writer, futurist, and cultural change strategist. He currently serves as a nonprofit executive and sits on boards in the higher education and nonprofit sectors, supporting the next generation of Black, Indigenous, and Chicano leaders and educators. Welcome, Patrick. It's really just a joy to have you here. We're delighted to be talking about your wonderful book.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, I'm going to start us off with actually two questions. The first one is, you ask yourself the question, what if I wrote as if I loved the reader? Why was love central in writing this book?
That's such a good question. I mean, part of it, one of my trainings is in critical pedagogies, and I'm a bell hooks lover fan. She's with the ancestors now, but you know, always in my heart. And one of the things I love about the way that she writes is she thinks about them very similarly, thinks about how do you write with love to your people. And I have this desire to move away from my critical academic training, which taught me to walk around with a flamethrower to everything. And just be critical about everything. And so I was trying to reposition some of my writing and work more in that vein, more in the vein of some great Chicano authors, Indigenous authors who have really tried to create stories so that way our people see ourselves reflected in those stories and can hear the voices of our ancestors and speak with the land that we know and love the children that we love and those descendants that have yet to be here. And so for me, love was central, and also just a helpful reminder throughout the writing process that that's actually what I'm called to. I'm not actually called to criticize everything, which was very easy when you're Black or brown in the academy, you know, because everything has not been designed for us, by us, or with us. So it's easy to get critical of saying, you know, I don't fit here. Well, I'm trying to reposition in the purpose gap and in all my work. What if we put us center? What if I put my family, my grandma in particular, now, what if I put Grandma Carmen as central to the work? That looks like a work of love that's honoring her and her love that she put out into the world.
Beautiful. Did you read bell hooks All About Love?
I did, and it's, you know, been really helpful in reframing. I'm part of a book project right now where I'm trying to reframe masculinity, and she does such a beautiful job of doing that. You know, machismo is a thing in the Chicano Mexican American community, so bell hooks is a reframe on what does it mean to be a man in love and what does it mean to reimagine how a man moves in the world. For me, is such a beautiful reframing for me. And yeah, I'm raising my son too to be caring, loving, and undoing some really toxic masculine things that we have going on in our culture in beautiful, loving ways. I think she does a wonderful job of how to reframe that for us.
I love to hear it. Bell Hooks is beloved here in Kentucky, of course, because where she's from. So tell us, what is the purpose gap?
Yeah, the purpose gap is, I was looking at kind of big data. So my first book, I was talking about vocation and meaning, how to find it. And it was a, kind of a traditional, here's some practices or tips or strategies to find something that matters to you. And I got really frustrated in the book. And I mentioned it right at the opening that I was out speaking on that book, and my dad calls me and tells me my cousin passed away. And I think he was formerly incarcerated. He had, addictions and afflictions that I haven't had to experience. And so I was really trying to wrestle with why am I here and he's not? He was a wonderful, brilliant guy. I mean, he's just similar to me. And so I started looking at like, what are the conditions that surrounded our different communities, and we're about 10 years apart. So different generation, different city that we grew up in, you know, really trying to take, and it just opened up a world of data to think about, okay, if you add up the housing gap, the education gap, the healthcare gap, the wage gap, the wealth gap, you start thinking about all these things between what dominant society has and what marginalized groups or formerly colonized or currently colonized groups or folks are facing, and trying to decolonize that. It meant that the purpose gap shows up in ways that, in the way that we talk to our children, the way that we dream of what you can be when you grow up. And so for me, it was trying to put a word to like, what happens to young Black and brown children in the United States in particular, when a whole bunch of resources aren't provided to them? You know, how does that impact their imagination about what is their purpose in life, or what provides them meaning in life? And what does that do? And what can we do about it? So the purpose gap is really, if you add up all those gaps, the healthcare, wealth, health, education gaps, and then say, what does that do to a young person? Or what does that do to the next generation? That's the purpose gap. It limits the imagination of what is possible.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And you talk about the image of spirit work and how the spirit helps to broaden our imagination and to imagine what is possible. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that and how the spirit is at work in this broadening of the conversation and the imagination.
Yeah, I have to credit Laura Rendon for that. She's also a critical pedagogue, a writer, educator, who really thought critically about how spirit shows up in our lives. And spirit can be defined in many things. You know, I work at a Christian organization, but I'm raising indigenous and Jewish children. My wife is indigenous and Jewish. So like, you know, spirit can be broadly defined as the ways that breath moves. You know, in my own Chicano indigenous traditions, it's the breath that blows through and out into the world. I think you find that in Hebrew scripture. So spirit for me is that movement of our ancestors and the ground and the earth to love, healing, compassion, these other aims that are not necessarily the things that are typically associated with purpose, like a job, you know, work, you know, more labor. I don't want more labor, you know. Yeah. I want more peace and love in my life. So spirit is critical for this work to accompany us, to come alongside. And I have a number of ways that I define that in the purpose gap. There's a deep animism in the purpose gap. I talk about, you know, walking with the coyotes in the arroyo, which I do regularly, just did it yesterday. You know, I talk about meeting my ancestors in dreams and having conversations with them. I also talk about my own sort of Chicano Catholic practices that help ground me in the traditions, the sacred traditions of the church I grew up in. And then my grandma had home practices. My grandma was also Kinandeta. So I have like indigenous practices that we do in the home to kind of cleanse the space. And so I think spirit is infused in all of that to help me really position my body, myself, in a better way with the communities I find myself in, to bring about the things I just mentioned, like love, healing, happiness.
That's really beautiful, because I think one of the things I get frustrated by in a lot of the writing about vocation is it feels very job-centered, you know, like what is the work for pay you're going to do that is hopefully something of the kindling of your heart. And of course, I would hope for that for all people. And it also seems so much deeper than that, as you say, that it's more about this way of being in the world and being in relationship to others and to all of creation. And it's a beautiful broadening out of that idea of what our purpose is. So thank you for that.
You mentioned the purpose gap in our own souls. Could you tell us more about what that is and how the purpose gap creates this soul purpose gap?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't reference this in the book because I was just listening to it yesterday, an audiobook, but I found these really great meditations from Henry Nouwen about, again, he's going back to spirit, and he was reflecting on the demonic or Diablo as a split in the spirit. And I think I was trying to reach for something very similar, and I wish I would have had access to his language during the book, but it was really around when the society or culture is oppressing you or putting these pressures on you, or you have had a lack of access to resources or opportunities to do them, the purpose gap that happens in our souls, at least that happened in my soul and the young people I work with who grew up in education desert, who grew up in the fields and all stuff, you start believing that you're not as capable, or that this system is set up in a particular way that, oh yeah, they are more deserving of the more resources that they have, that they are more deserving of those opportunities, that I'm not as smart or I'm not as brilliant. And this has a profound effect on not just, I'd say, the split in our souls, you know, like, what am I capable of? I remember my first year in grad school being like, what the heck am I doing here? Like, I can't keep up with anyone here. But, you know, I'm about to go back and be the commencement speaker for my alma mater at that master program, the same thing, because it was like, it took me a couple of years to kind of settle and say like, oh, my grandma has something to teach this place. My people have something to teach this place that's missing here. My descendants will probably want to be here or occupy this space. So they need me to do my work full throated. So that way they see someone reflected in them, because I was the first to go. So some of that work is really about trying to mend that, like, you know, that we can call it imposter syndrome, or, you know, that kind of pain that comes with almost the system told me this, and I don't want to believe it, but I'm feeling the weight of those words, or I'm feeling the weight of this system on me. And it can really limit the imagination around what is possible because that's how the system's designed to do. It's designed to take our souls. I mean, I think colonization, I write about this in the purpose gap for indigenous Chicano folks like myself. I mean, the way that exists, or colonization exists, is to eradicate us. And that's it. You know, like, if you can assimilate, you have these other words, assimilate, well, that's an erasure. You know, you've had to erase all your indigenous ancestry. You've had to erase your complexity of your people. You know, so for me, that like disconnect in the soul, that purpose gap in the soul, really comes from that place where some of us start to believe it, not because we want to, but because it's like, oh, well, I didn't get access to these things.
I completely understand. I'm a first and only first person in my family with a bachelor's degree, first person in my family with a master's degree. I am too old to get a doctorate. Don't you guys get any ideas? I remember being in community college. And the education desert that I grew up in, where I had a D average in high school. And then when I finally, and I dropped out of high school. And when I finally went back, it was because my sixth grade teacher found out that I had dropped out, and he thought I was very bright. And he was like, hey, I'll give you a scholarship to go to college if you go back and finish. And so I went back because I wanted to go to missionary school, and I found out they don't take high school dropouts. And I remember how disorienting it was. Of course, you know, my grade point average shot up because to what it was supposed to be. But at some point, I was offered a full ride for a four-year college, and I didn't take it, because I didn't know what that looked like. I didn't know what it was like to leave home. I didn't know what, I had no frame of reference, and it frightened me. And there was nobody in my family to say, girl, you will regret that when those student loans come in. There was no one there, because no one knew that. That was no one's experience in my family. So yeah, I completely identify. And, you know, for me, that lack of identity was, you know, that gap in my soul between who I thought I was and who I could possibly be. And when I finally did get these degrees, I felt like I changed the trajectory of my entire family, mm-hmm. because my kids can go to college. In fact, three of them have, and their kids, but not just my kids, you know, my nieces, my nephews. So it wasn't just for me. So I get that. Thank you. And thank you for letting me share my story.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for that, Claudia Love. It's really powerful. And it makes me think about, you know, as I was reading and Patrick, when you were talking about, you know, you've obviously excelled in your field and in your life through education and all these things. And so I think about a lot of white people, particularly in the religious right, who would say, you know, why can't more people of color be like you? Why can't, you know what I mean? Doesn't it just take that kind of pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of mentality to overcome, you know what I mean? So do you have a way to respond to people like that, that might help them to understand, you know, what the obstacles are, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I put in the purpose gap, I talk a little bit about bootstraps, how it's, you know, it was never meant to be a serious saying anyways, you know, like I think we've lost the fact that it was meant to be hilarious. Like the whole idea is that you would take your bootstraps off your shoes and throw them over and pull yourself over a fence with them. So it was always meant to be stupid. Like you can't actually do it. For some reason, some probably folks who are leveraging that and didn't really review or look at the history of the thing and say like, maybe we shouldn't use this as a way to tell people to actually, you know, level themselves up in life. Yeah. I mean, I would say that, you know, part of the, I don't think, and I talk a little about it in the book I call it the cultural commute. You know, what is cultural commute that certain communities or individuals or have to do in order to make it in mainstream America? So I write a lot about higher education because that's kind of where I live and where I do most of my work. But that's, you know, even for folks who have gone, for first generation folks, it's not easy. I mean, in my own sort of, as Claudia Love just shared, I mean, it's hard. In my own journey, it was in undergrad being thrown out, and I was a history major, throwing out of History 101, like the core course, within 1 week, because the teacher assumed by reading my last name said, well, you know, you might be an ESL student. Like my dad made sure we knew English, you know, like, and we write well. That was never a problem. It was just an assumption he made. I was going to a state access college. So I get thrown out of this class. I technically didn't get thrown out. Let me say, I dropped the course. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to convince this man I can do anything in this class. Like he's made his mind up. I got to find something else. So I dropped out. I was working full time. So I didn't have time for that. But it's stuff like that, that like, I didn't have a coach and have a mentor. I didn't have an advocate. I couldn't go to, you know, I didn't know to go we didn't have a diversity, equity, inclusion officer at the time. So I didn't have anyone to go to and say like, hey, look, I'm pretty sure this is discrimination. I need help here. You know, I was in grad school my first semester. I write this story in my book. I was asked to leave halfway through an exam because I was working full time. I was hanging sheetrock all night. So I showed up covered in this white gypsum powder, sweaty, stinky. And the professor tells me I'm a distraction to the more serious students, not a distraction to the rich students, or not a distraction to the white students, or not a distraction to these students who have access who don't have to work at night. But I was a distraction to the more serious students. And, you know, talked about that question around specifically around the purpose gap that lives inside us. I mean, there was a moment, several moments where I was thinking, oh, I need to take out loans because I need to be serious. And that's what I ended up doing, because I had to assume that was the right way to go, rather than knowing how to challenge that professor and say like, I am serious. I'm representing my community. I'm 3,000 miles away from the closest relative I have. And I've traveled the farthest of any of my family ever. I'm the first to do this work ever. So you have no idea the amount of grit and work that's coming here. I'm more serious than any other student that you have here by a long shot. You're just doing different math. So part of what I hope to offer up in the purpose gap, and this is part of the reason why the framing is, if you're you know, white, you're reading over our shoulders to hopefully see that these things are not debatable. These are facts. These are facts of that cultural commute for some people is just longer. You know, I'd say just on this call, if we were operating in the world, the cultural commute for me as a man is way shorter than for either of you as women. That's a fact. Like there are certain rooms I can just go into. I can, you know, we do workplace survey. Number of the conversations about how strategy was built before the pandemic happened in the men's bathroom. You know, like that's a clear distinction of design that certain people, certain bodies don't have access to. And there's hard data around this. So I think about these things around like cultural commute shouldn't be that hard to explain to folks that say like these things are facts, but they impact so many people. And my offer up is that there really is this radical individualism that we think we have, the you know, the American myth of you can do that, you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps, is at its etymology a falsehood, which is a stupid saying already. And it's not actually possible. It really is about how, what access you have to resources in your community.
Yeah, I think, oh, go ahead, Calvia.
I was going to say, and here's another thing. Some of us are over here like, wait, there were boots?
Yes. Yeah, I think what I really appreciated, well, one of the things I appreciated, because there were lots of them, was the mix of the hard data, which was very compelling in terms of, you know, giving people like a very concrete way of seeing this, as well as then the spirit infused, you know, loving voice that permeates the whole thing. So you did, I think it was a beautiful job of weaving those two things together. And I appreciate that. Yeah.
Patrick, what is a preferential option for silenced and forgotten voices? And why is it important that these voices are amplified?
It's a great question. I mean, part of I'm borrowing preferential option for the poor, which comes from Catholic social teaching and liberation theology. To say that preferential option is trying to find those. I was thinking very practically, people like my grandma who didn't have a formal education, who was the knowledge keeper, wisdom keeper, healer, practitioner. She was all the things in our community. And none of her stuff was written down. It should have been. I mean, she's the wisest, most loving human I've ever known. So it was try to take inventory of, you know, what are the things that we need to capture for our people? So that way, when my Carmelita grows up, she can see my grandma Carmen represented that. She can connect with her as an ancestor in, to be very direct, in formal education, for it to count as formal education. I mean, people often, when I'm talking about either the books or any of the work I do, you know, what's some of your joys about this? Like, oh, my grandma's teaching in places that I never thought she would, you know, that she never could imagine that she'd be being taught. People are saying her name and talking about what she did in the world. Like that's a gift. That's a gift that will give, you know, go on for generations. So now when I say that preferential option, I think so many of us could do more of that work in our own lives. You know, how does our own writing reflect those places that have been erased or forgotten in our own histories, our own legacies? What are the places where it's been intentionally erased? You know, when do we get back to? I'm thinking of folks who have histories and narratives tied to the transatlantic slave trade, you know, black and white, you know, folks who came over and, you know, your family record stops because of slavery. And for those white folks, your record continues because of slavery, because you have assets and holdings in human bodies. Like, what do you do with that? And I think some of that hidden or preferential options for those histories that are not told was for me to really go those places and challenge everyone to see those places as that's the formal curriculum that we should be looking at. That's the deep dive that we should be doing. The traditions of the land. How do you learn about the plants and the land and how it's moved and really get into its longer history? That's the work I was hopefully calling us all to in the Purpose Gap, to do a better inventory of that and to be more honest about those histories and the impact that they have on us now who are learning.
Yes, I 100% agree. Thank you.
Yeah, one of the things that you talk about in the book is that, you say that you really hope your readers will realize that to overcome this purpose gap, that we have to do this work together. And you have this lovely quote where you say, don't believe the self-help literature that finding your purpose is the key to happiness. This work is not a solo act. Even Jesus could not perform his purpose alone. And so I wondered if you could talk more about that, the communal nature of this overcoming the purpose gap, and if you have worked with churches at all and helping them move from this more individualized notion of vocation to a more communal one, and if there's any ways to help shift that kind of narrative, I guess, and that paradigm.
I love it. I mean, part of the things that I feel like I missed out on vocation or my own training in it, you know, through graduate education, my own doctoral research, was this idea that the scriptures actually do have very complex call narratives that we never learn. It's like, you know, we get the like sliver of text that says God called and then they went and did, you know, like, and it's like, oh, why don't we all have that? And I look at like Jesus and Luke, like he's out there in the desert wrestling and figuring out his stuff. He's figured it out. He comes back home. He declares it in front of his community. And everyone's like, aren't you Joseph's kid? That's their response to him. Like, who are you telling us this? Like, are you for reals? Which felt like, that feels like very real to me. That feels like when I go back home, like, dude, you're Pat. Like, we remember playing baseball with you. Like, what are you, you're writing books? Are you kidding me? Like, people read that? Are you sure? You know, like, that's what home will do for you. That's what your people will do for you. And what follows right after that is before Jesus gets to work, he goes and finds his 12 homies. Like that's his next move is to like, okay, I know I can't do this work alone. It didn't work in the desert when I was by myself. It didn't work when I declared it to my people. What I needed to do was start being in conversation with other humans. So the call narrative there for me is like, I'm looking at Jesus as a good example. I mean, I know that's hard for Christians to do sometimes, but I think Jesus provides a pretty good example of a call narrative there. You know, so I'm trying to reimagine that. I go back to my own doctoral research where I also, so my project was really looking at how folks who work in the field, so those folks who are out there picking lettuce, working in snap peas, putting together those fancy little vegetable trays you have at parties, and spending time working alongside them. And my question was, what in your spiritual and religious lives help you find meaning in this one? Like, tell me about this. And I had a lot of assumptions because I was in a religious program, because I was doing a degree, a doctoral degree in theology, that I would get things like practices, like, oh, I go to church on Sunday, or I have a conversation with my priest, or I carry around my rosary. And what came back in the data was just like, it rocked my world. It was soccer on Saturdays, because that was the one time they felt like their family could be free. Their kids could run and have joy, and they could watch them laugh and have fun. And they had their little side hustles, you know, selling meat or, you know, whatever they were doing at it. It was for a full day. They were 100%, they had 100% agency over their life. Whereas on Sunday, they didn't feel that. And definitely not Monday through, you know, Monday through Friday, because they were working 10 to 14 hours for below poverty wages, only parts of the year, to put food on our tables, not even on their own. So though that sort of like turn, like, okay, well, if this is, you're coming here for a community, what does that look like? What does practice look like? And it became this like thing that I grew up with. But again, I had to say, this is center to vocation, that aunties, tias, my titis, you know, like grandmas, central to the way that we discern our vocation, the ways that we find meaning and purpose in life. Why have I not read about a single auntie in any vocational literature? That blows my mind. You know, I think about my aunts. They are the who I am. They made me, for better or for worse. They made me. You know, like, so I think about these people, the folks in my community and in my research, who were showing up time and time again. And for some reason, all the mainstream literature on vocation just, I guess, forgot, or maybe they didn't have any. You know, I feel bad for white folks who didn't know that they had a great aunt that could, you know, actually love them into existence. I'm sure they did. They just didn't think about it, write about it. So for me, it was really to say, oh, for vocation to do this really well. And what I'm seeing from my community is it is never an individual act. That is a very American white Western thing, way to think. You know, just one more example. I'm a part of a group that folks should look up and research. It's called the Belonging Project. And the Belonging Project is a group of, you know, mostly Christian identified researchers who are trying to figure out what does it mean to belong? How do we think about belonging? What are the downsides of belonging? All that kind of stuff. And we had this conversation about family, which this shows up a lot in the purpose gap. And one of the things that we were arguing about was like, you know, how family needs to be deconstructed and challenged. And these are white researchers, right? And I said, I think when you say family and I say familia or I say family, we mean different things. You think nuclear. And yes, I can see how that'd be a problem if you have an abusive parent like I had. I could see how that'd be a problem if you aren't getting along with your siblings or bad things happen within that small nuclear unit. But I'm only here because of family, because of who I belong to, because my aunts took me in, because my grandma took me in when these things happen. So I have a broader definition of who I belong to. So we're not starting at the same place. And you need to check your assumptions about we can't use family anymore because I need it. I need it to survive. And it doesn't look like yours at all, but it looks like something that I think we can recover. Our starting place is village. It's not nuclear. So, you know, when I think about the purpose gap and the things I put in there, it's just to name, I say this at the very beginning, we have a very different starting place. The language may be similar, but we have a different starting place. And that results in a different way of thinking about these categories.
Yeah, it's a completely new, like different paradigm. Yeah, from the very get-go. So thank you for that. I appreciate that so much.
Turning the other cheek. It might not be what we have been led to believe. Could you talk to us about that and your experience in learning that lesson?
It was beautiful. The whole moment was beautiful. I'm reading some more. I'm returning actually to it this week. Walter Wink's work on Jesus and the third way and, you know, his powers were some of the first kind of connections that I read between the decolonial, post-structuralist, like challenge of empire that I was reading that was tied to these kind of theological language I got. So I was like pumped up around, okay, this guy's doing it. But I always had this, like in grad school, I had this critical eye, like everything y'all are teaching me, I can't take home. You know, like I had the, you know, I said, I you know, opened this up with, I had a flamethrower and I was ready to use it. So Walter Wink comes to Boston University and he's facilitating a moment where he's going over three challenges. You could read about this in his parable series because he does this analysis in the third book. He really, he writes out this story, but he played it out too. Like it was the first time I saw someone play out literature. For those who are not familiar with the Catholic, you know, upbringing that I had, the homilies are always super boring, very rarely on topic. And there's no real movement. So I'd never seen anyone play out scripture like in their body. And so he had these three stories he works through. And one of them is the turn the other cheek story. And so he invited folks up to kind of interact with him to tease out the text. And so he invited me. And we have this moment where he shows me around the way that, you know, slapping someone backhanded would be considered disrespect, or they'd be considering like you're equal, right? This would be the disrespect is backhand. To respect someone, be open hand, to slap them across because you're actually trying to fight them. And so he goes to demonstrate this to me. So, you know, I'm sitting there like a puffed up my chest, Chicano, I got my neck all flared up. Like, you know, my wife hates it when I do it around town. Like when I get all nervous and stuff, like I try to make, I'm like a little rooster walking around Santa Fe. And so I'm doing that in front of all my class colleagues. And so he goes, okay, so I'm just going to act this out really slowly. Don't worry, Patrick, you know, take a deep breath. We'll be fine. I'm going to slap you once and then I'm going to show you. And it turned there and he had said everything he was going to do. He had read through the scripture. And so he backhands me. So I, you know, do this little thing. Like I turn my cheek and he goes, okay, now when I say turn the other cheek, give me the other cheek. And I started like turn my face and he goes, now how do I have to slap you? And I go, oh, if I'm using the same hand, if I'm using my dominant hand, I got to slap you like an equal. And I'm like red faced, puff chest in his face. Like, how dare you slap me? Like I was carrying a little too much anger at this. He was very old this time. You know, I think he was only a couple of years from when he passed on. And so I'm sitting there like, I'm going to have to, everyone's going to see me beat this dude up. And, and it had like a light bulb moment for me. Like, oh, like, what's happening here? Jesus actually challenging me and my people to stand up as equals. And I'm staring at him. I'm sure I'm like sort of shaking. And he goes, speaks over my life, says, I can tell you come from a long line of strong people. You want to be equal with those who are oppressing you. Like, that's your challenge. You are brave and courageous. And I'm like, now talk about bell hooks, you know, all about love. Like, I'm flipping on the other side. Like, now I'm like completely fragile. I'm like open and broken open. Like, yes, I am. I am descended of all those loving people. And I am standing here face to face with you. And we are equals. And so that challenge to turn the other cheek isn't take more abuse. It's to affirm my grandma. Like, holy crap. That's a beautiful reframe of that text. And it opened up my eyes to like, okay, I might have been told this story wrong. I might have been, this whole thing might have been framed in a different way. I need to look at this in a different light. And here's a person who I would not imagine in a body teaching me something, offering a gift to my people and a gift to my soul. It was a beautiful, beautiful and unfortunate young adult moment where I probably, it worked a lot better for him because I came in with all that negative energy. And it worked really good for my soul because I started in such a low place. But it cracked open for me something like, oh, okay, this is, I can get down with this Jesus. That's amazing.
It is amazing. Thank you.
I love that. So speaking about ancestors and your grandmother, and even going back to the question about the communal, familial nature of the purpose gap, you talk about how your grandmother witnessed to this way of being, which has to do with intuition. I really liked what you said about intuition as the expression of guides and spirits, and how the wisdom and spirit of your ancestors lives in your very bones. And you say it was her ability to slow us down and draw on the deep ancestral wisdom she carried in her very body. Intuition is not another form of problem solving. It draws on the love that threads its way through generations, which is such a beautiful image. So can you tell us more about the role that intuition plays, and particularly that connection to the ancestors and how it draws that love down? Because I just love that image.
Yeah, in that chapter, I'm really trying to reclaim and redefine intuition. I think it has been misused and misappropriated that intuition is something that you just know, that you're the right person. You have all the right answers. And that's wrong. No, I think the intuition should be that guiding spirit that kind of draws you inward to push you outwards, to like seek the wisdom in that story that my grandma was doing, is to get me to pay attention to what she was telling me, what family was telling me, what the hummingbirds and the butterflies were telling me, what slowing down could actually do for me to open me up for something that needed to emerge in me. Like, maybe what needed to emerge in me was going to come in here. It was a question I was wrestling with, but the answer wasn't going to be found in me just asking myself over and over and over again to get the right answer. I opened that story. I'm the most eloquent lines in the whole book is, you know, trust your intuition unless your intuition sucks. Because, and I give the example of traveling and driving around when I was at work, and two dudes in the front car trying to find our way in a town we'd never been to, trusting our intuition. Like, we could just pick the rights and lefts by looking, like just talking to each other. And that's not true. Good intuition would have said, oh, you're lost. You should pull over and ask for directions. You know, like as a wisdom keeper, like find ways to get at the answer. So intuition for me was really about orienting us towards that middle space, not for the answer, but for the process in which we find clarification, where we find clarity. It's that in-between space that we need to be oriented towards, as opposed to, hey, intuition's about you knowing what the end goal is the whole time. Like, you knew it from the beginning. No, intuition is more about the process. How do you follow those guiding spirits, those people around you that might offer, speak wisdom or love into your life?
I love that about the process. We do. Our community looks at the intersection of contemplative practice and creative process, and very much focused on that, like the moment by moment unfolding and what we know in this moment Yeah, but we don't know what's in the next moment until we get there. Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, glad I loved you. Want to maybe ask about the meditation since we're just to make sure we have enough time for it.
Yeah, I was so touched by the beautiful guided meditation about the people who love us into our purpose. That's just such a stunning idea. Could you tell us how you came up with it and how you use guided meditations like this to help us grow into our purpose? And then after, could you kindly lead us into the meditation on about the people who love us into our purpose?
It's a great question around how that those guides work. I mean, they're visualizations. I'm big on visualizations. A part of it was the invitation from my grandma. She used to do a version of that with me all the time. It really was a, when I was super reactive, you know, I was a teenager when I was living with them, and you know, my adrenaline was always going. My testosterone never turned off. So she was always, you know, hands on the shoulder, mijo, I love you. You're okay. Who else loves you? Name them, you know. So a very embodied process with her there, and I really wanted to connect with her, especially with my kids, you know, to really start doing, to see her and bring her into existence for me on a daily level. And so the visualization really came out of me combining that practice where she would do those questions that are in there with me, like in person. She'd be looking at me at my eyes and me saying, oh, I could just go here all the time if I really want to. So let me try to build a visualization or do a visualization that allows myself and others to do that as well. And because I think, you know, going back to the intuition question or all the conversations that we've had so far, it's really about how do we connect with other people who have loved us into existence, how we reconnect with that kind of spirit. And I do this practice with my kids, and my kids are amazing. I'm just say as a framing of this, my daughter does this practice. It's a beautiful, I have recordings from her when she was three, she's six now, at least one every single for year of her life where she's doing some sort of guided visualization where she gets there. And this is, you know, probably about a year and a half ago now, she was leading me in this exercise that we're about to do. And it's just with kids. So if anyone's doing these visualizations with kids, it works great, especially at bedtime. And one of the things we do with visualization is every time you give a new prompt, I ask my kids to squeeze my hand to let me know that they're at that next level. So if I ask them to visualize, let's say a Coke, squeeze my hand when you can feel or when you can see that Coke, just so I know that they're tracking along because she's younger and it's hard to do that. So anyways, she's leading me and I'm supposed to be squeezing her hand. She's doing this exercise with me and I was super anxious. I was having a hard time at work that week. And I'm pretty sure I was just like squeezing the heck out of her hand. And so she stops the meditation, says, Pa, stop hurting me. You're squeezing my hand too tight. I said, okay, I'm sorry, Carmelita. And she goes, and grandma wants you to know that I'm leading you. She's never met my grandma. Never, ever. I mean, she's her namesake. I mean, I say this all the time. I sit between five generations of Carmelita. My grandma's Carmelita. My daughter's Carmelita. She's telling me, my grandma's telling her to tell me to chill out. that she's got this. What a beautiful moment for this. So I try to invite people into that practice. So if we are cool with it, I would love to do that now. And then I'll offer a little framing for folks who want to do something slightly different that I've been doing a lot with groups right after. We good? We can do it?
Yeah,
all right. Great. So I'm going to invite you to get comfortable, to close your eyes, remind yourself to breathe. Take a deep breath in, deep breath out, deep breath in, deep breath out. Make sure to relax any tension you're feeling, starting at the top of your head. Relax your forehead. Relax your cheeks, your jaw. Notice and release any tension you feel in your neck or shoulders. Relax those arms. Release those hands. Relieve any tension in your lower back. And notice your feet on the floor. I want you to call to your imagination someone who loves you. Someone who calls you beloved. Someone who loves you more than anything. Bring into focus their face. Imagine this person who loves you in their fullness. See them sitting across from you. Take a moment to notice the color of their hair, shape of their face, color of their eyes, shape of their nose, and see them smiling at you. Notice how this feels to sit with a person who you know loves you more than anything. See them smiling at you because they're proud. They love you. They love you more than anything. And as you sit with this person who loves you more than anything, I want you to see them extend their hand and place it on your shoulder. Notice them smiling at you with their hand on your shoulder. And I want you to, in your imagination, hear the words that you need to hear right now from this person who loves you more than anything. What is it that you need to hear that only this person can tell you? Let those words wash over you like a gift. And notice the way that you feel receiving this gift from someone who calls you beloved. As you sit with this gift, I want you to see yourself expressing gratitude. Express gratitude for this person who loves you, for those words, and see yourself doing that in the way that you know how with this person. It could be with a loving kiss, a hug, a smile, but see yourself expressing gratitude for this moment and for that gift. Again, notice the way the gratitude is showing up in your body. How does it make you feel? And know that our time with this person who loves you is coming to an end. Begin to say goodbye in the way that you say goodbye to this person. Again, it could be a loving hug, a kiss. Could be a wave, but see them slowly fading from your imagination. as they fade away in your mind's eye, take one last moment to notice how you feel, how this experience was to sit with someone who loves you, to hear words that you need to hear, to express gratitude with this person, and to ultimately say goodbye to them. You sit here in your imagination by yourself. Know that you can come back here to sit with your beloved whenever you need. When life is overwhelming, when life is full of joy, you can call to your mind this person who loves you to sit with them, even for just a moment. As we're ready, podcast crew, we can come on back. Now, I don't know who y'all saw or who the listenership saw, if they were able to do the visualization practice, but the hope is that we can connect, whether it's ancestors or children or, you know, our loving partners. I know my wife loves the version of me that shows up in this a lot more than the actual version in the flesh, you know. You know, this is an invitation to really call to mind those who love us and love and reorient our spirit towards what we deserve to be called beloved. That's the practice. That's the practice in the book. It's the practice we do. And just one last offering, one shift I've been making in public spaces. I typically do I end with visualization practice that we do. For the last couple of years, I've been doing this one, but I've shifted a little bit to a futurist practice. And part of that invitation is to do some self-love stuff. So rather than look back or call to mind someone who loves us, I invite people to do a very similar walk through, get grounded, get settled, and then to step into the future, 10 years into the future. And that person that they're sitting across from is them sitting in front of a mirror, and they see themselves 10 years into the future. They see how they've aged. They, you know, they imagine how their clothes have changed. They see themselves 10 years into the future. And part of the invitation then is to say that person 10 years in the future is looking back saying the same, very similar sentiment that they love you. They're grateful for the work that you have put in, the things that you have done to get them to where they are, because they are living the life that you have designed and have wanted for them. And so this could be, you know, not just calling other people, but recently it's been about how do we do some of that deeper work of inviting ourselves to really do, I think, Claudia Love, you named it, that when our soul is split and broken, how do we do some of that repair? Well, it looks like looking into the future, I'm hoping that future Pat is very proud of what I'm trying to put in place in these little things, and I can start to visualize and imagine what those things are. So that's just an addition to this practice that I've been adding on. But I appreciate the invitation to share.
Yeah. Wow. Lovely, lovely, lovely. Thank you so much. Yeah. And thank you for joining us.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I loved that too. And it was such a simple practice and yet really, really profound. And I love so much that your daughter does this with you and leads you in this.
That's right.
And picturing her little hand squeezing. Anyway, I'm really moved by that image. Thank you so much, Patrick. This book is really powerful. The Purpose Gap, Empowering Communities of Color to Find Meaning and Thrive. I can't actually read that well because I've got little tears in my eyes from my meditation. Read the book and thank you so much. We're just really grateful to have your wisdom here shared with our community.
Oh, thank you for having me.